Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to a wit-attaining podcast, which you can listen to over the next few hours, hopefully fully relaxed. And it's a pretty good show, actually.
We have reviews of Machete, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, Leapy Ear, Unstoppable, The American. And we are joined in the studio by...
A gentleman by the name of Gareth Edwards, not the rugby legend, but probably a new name to you. He is a director. He has made a movie called Monsters. He's made it for about 3 and sixpence. And it's quite extraordinary that correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't feel as though it's made for 3 and sixpence.
It really doesn't. It feels like a proper big budget movie that actually could have as many special effects as it wants. It just doesn't want that many.
Also, you should know, and just a little bit of warning, the programme does contain a miracle.
It does.
Thank you. Here comes the show.
How are you in this incredibly hot studio?
What they've done is they've set the thermostat so as cold as it gets outside, that's as hot as it gets in here.
I mean, you know, when people say we have a hot radio program,
you can always take your jacket off if things get too hot. Why not?
No, I can't. I'm not broadcasting in my shirt sleeves.
I'm broadcasting in my
t-shirt. Yeah, but you could broadcast in your pants. You have no savoir faire. You know what? Why don't you? No, I am fully suited and booted, and I'm not taking it off just because the weather doesn't agree with me.
We start with a complaint from Dean Goldsmith. In regard, Mark...
With regard.
Now, I've told you before, do not correct listeners.
How far are we into the program? 7 minutes
in. It's remarkably patronising.
Yep.
In regard to my VHS copy of Les Yeux Sans Visage, which I never received from you and Mark Radcliffe in 1992...
Oh, you're kidding.
...and which I have previously made of to you...
Would
it be possible to now you not receive it on DVD, as I now no longer own a video player? Many thank you.
Just to gloss, I mean, I haven't heard that email before, but just to
the
gloss.
The point is, you let someone down and you've corrected them twice in the course of four lines.
Can I be clear about this? I feel that it's the BBC that let someone down, albeit me that corrected them grammatically. I used to do a thing on the Radcliffe Show, you know, the Cult Film Corner, and we did indeed do Les Yeux Sans Visage, Eyes Without a Face, when it came out on the then old recording format of videotape. I believe some of you may have some up in the loft. And if we didn't do that... Actually, funny enough, the person who was in charge of prize, this sounds like the worst... I'm going to do the Barack Obama thing and say it happened under my watch, therefore it is my fault. But the person who was in charge of all that stuff was actually Mark Riley.
A.K.A. Lard.
A.K.A. Lard. A.K.A. Happy Fall bassist. He was fantastic in the recent series of Fall documentaries that seem to have been shown on television. So, yeah, has the gentleman caller, you're not the gentleman I was expecting.
Has he what?
Has he sent an address?
Well, it's an email. If you want to follow that up and visit him, that would be great.
No, if he sends an address, I will indeed.
Okay. Dean, send us an address.
And I'll send you a VHS copy of Les Yeux Sans Visage.
Tom in Addleston. I saw this joke. I thought you might like it. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
No, actually, that's not going to work, so I'm going to do it all. Knock, knock. Who's there? To who? No, to whom?
See. John in West... That reminded me of the Anton Corbin joke. Remember when Anton Corbin was in? We were talking about his film later on. Anton Corbin, he said, there was a bit of Dutch humour there. And I said, oh, would you tell us a Dutch joke? He said, yeah, I'll tell you a Dutch joke. Man goes into a bar, it's closed. That's it. That's the Dutch humour.
When he told it, it was slightly more hilarious.
No, it wasn't. That was what was so funny about it. It wasn't funny at all.
John Catterfeld in West Hampstead. Whilst listening to your podcast as usual this week, I was struck halfway through by a disturbing sense of dread when you wished Ben Lyons good luck for his impending Philadelphia Marathon last weekend. As a regular listener, I know for a fact that the last person you wished good luck to in a marathon was me back in April.
Oh,
it was shortly after hearing your shout-out during my marathon that I stopped at the 22-mile mark for a breather and promptly passed out, waking 24 hours later in intensive care. Whilst I can't in any way blame your wit-attainment for my near-death
experience... Although I can tell you're having a go...
I am very concerned to check that there is no Mayo Kermode curse and that Ben actually made it round his marathon safely and in a respectable time. For my own peace of mind, could you ask Ben to get in touch and confirm his good health? I've gone through about 150 emails this morning and I haven't seen one from...
No word of Ben.
Yeah. So, Ben, get in touch. John concludes, personally, I'm now fully recovered and my anecdote about spending a week in hospital is always closely followed by my claim to fame of having Mark and Simon G me up en route.
Or G you down.
While we're on the subject...
Wasn't that a film by Pedro Almodovar, G me up, G me down?
While we're on the subject of medical matters, let me read you this quite extraordinary email and stay with me till the end.
Okay.
All right? It's from Grace Cassie. Dear Angel and Demon, I've been a devoted listener to the podcast for the past year, having been introduced by my friend Andrew, a Seattle exile who has been living in the UK for 5 years and is engaged to my good friend Hermione. We have shared many discussions of the Good Doctor's reviews, a particular favourite being the supreme rant stimulated by Angels and Demons. Excuse me, my throat is now so dry because of the heat that we've reached in this studio. Fill the gap.
This is like the gag about the man who's in the desert and a guy comes up to him and he says, have you got any water? He says, no, I've got a tie. He says, no, I don't want ties. He goes to the next guy. He says, have you got any water? He says, no, we've got ties. He says, I don't want a tie. He goes to the next guy. He says, you want water? He goes, no, I've got ties. And then finally, in the distance, he sees a hotel. It's clearly a mirage. And he walks up. He goes, as he gets nearer and nearer, he realizes it's not a mirage. And he gets there and he goes, water. And the guy says, sorry, sir, you can't come in here with that tie.
Now, Grace's email was not intended to have a joke halfway through, but it has enabled some lubrication too.
And you're still having to lubricate even more.
Yeah. Anyway, Grace goes on. I have not written before, but felt I should share with you the events of the last 2 weeks. On Friday the 1st of October, Andrew, who is 34 and a keen runner and cyclist, suffered a serious cardiac arrest while having dinner with friends. His heart stopped for around 45 minutes. He was kept alive by the CPR efforts of his heroic friend Lucas.
This is going to have a happy ending, isn't it?
Bear with me. Okay.
Okay.
All right. His heart stopped for around 45 minutes and he was kept alive by the CPR efforts of his heroic friend Lucas and the police and paramedics who quickly attended. He was taken to University College Hospital in London and put on life support. He had not regained consciousness and was kept in a coma with a very poor prognosis. His family flew immediately from America to be with him. He was chilled to a hypothermic state to protect his brain. We could only wait for him to stabilise. We spent hours talking to him, but without any sign of response. By the middle of last week, he had stabilised enough for the doctors to reduce his sedation and attempt to wake him. For some time, he was only able to make tiny movements and did not seem to be responding to voices. At this point, we realised that there was one doctor who had not yet been consulted. It was, of course, Dr. K, Medicine Man. That's you. Okay.
Okay. Despite the fact that Medicine Man was a film starring Sean Connery with a bad toupee, I really hope this is going to have a good ending.
Searching through the archived podcasts, we found the Angels and Demons cracker, and Hermione played the relevant running and explaining the plot section to Andrew. Here's the bit. And yes, he moved his head towards the speaker from which was pouring Dr. K's splenetic outburst. From there, it was onwards and upwards, and I'm delighted to tell you Andrew is now awake, walking unaided, and with recovery in prospect. Is that extraordinary or what?
Unbelievable.
So, says Grace.
Unbelievable, and grammatically correct.
So, which is clearly such a relief to everyone. You know, they've got to the end of that email, and they're going, do you know, thank the good Lord there was no grammatical error in that email.
That's a true
story. Shall I conclude?
Right? There's more.
Yeah. Thanks to Dr. K, as well as the amazing team at UCH, who I think probably should get the other way around.
It's probably all their medical stuff that helped a little bit.
Thanks to them all for bringing Andrew back from the brink. Good news is hard to find sometimes, but at last we've found the reason for the making of Angels and Demons. It is a redeemed film.
It is.
Okay. Why am I writing, says Grace. Well, frankly, Grace...
Frankly, that was enough.
Andrew and Hermione are getting married on Saturday. Andrew is planning a shout-out to Jason Isaacs in his speech, so if Dr. K's saving his life and Jason Isaacs appearing in the speech doesn't warrant a quick hello on the programme, then I'm giving up and going to break all the etiquette rules in my local cinema. Grace Cassie, BA Honours, Cantab History, London via Southampton, Bugle Street in the Old Town near the Harbour Light Cinema. Now, I would suggest that is the most extraordinary. It's either an entire fabrication.
In which case, it's a well-written fabrication.
So, forgiven.
So, forgiven because you wrote it well.
But actually, that actually means that Angels and Demons is a redeemed film, and I'm very glad.
Yes.
Genuinely, if that film hadn't been made, you wouldn't have ranted in such a splenetic manner.
I love that word.
And Andrew might still be just lying there. But instead, as you ranted, he moved his head. You are a lifesaver. We bow down in your company.
No, you don't. It's a lovely email. What a fantastic story. And the name of the gentleman who is now?
I think you know those flappy hands of yours?
Yes.
I think they might be, in the words of Elton John, healing hands.
Are they? You need hands.
No, that's not
to hold a little baby.
That's not Elton John.
Isn't it?
No.
Wasn't it? He was on the radio yesterday. He sounded like that to me.
No.
Okay. All right.
Grace, thank you very much indeed for your email.
How does Healing Hands by Elton John go?
Reach out. And so on. Fill in the gap.
That's the same as what I did. Hey, you need hands.
Anyway, so there you go. So you have... If there are any other...
Max Bygraves. Sorry.
I wonder how many miracles you have to perform before you get to be a saint. Because I think the Catholic Church might be... I'm going to forward this to the
Dear Pope.
Because
following your recent comments on the use of...
Is this the first miracle that has been attributed to Saint Mark? I know there's been a Saint Mark. Saint Wittertainment, then.
Saint Wittertainment.
Because I obviously facilitated.
Yeah, yeah. No, let's not write your role out of this. This didn't... this is, you know, I think it's more the BBC, really, isn't it? In the public service broadcasting remit.
Oh, I love that.
That's fantastic. And the name of the gentleman who is now getting better?
It's Andrew, who is getting married to... Hermione.
Andrew and Hermione getting married to this Saturday tomorrow.
I imagine that is tomorrow, and they're going to mention Jason. And I think we should, we should have gone, shouldn't we?
We should have gone. We only just read it out now.
I know.
But we wish them the very best of luck.
Indeed, we do. Thank you very much. Send us some photographs, and we should put the photographs as proof of the miracle as part of the campaign.
Oh,
to get
you
us
doubting Thomas? I want proof of the miracle.
Put it on the website. It's a Wittertainment wedding. It's the first Wittering wedding. That's what we've just created. What an extraordinary moment.
In advance of the top 10, can I just call out for listener reviews of Guzarish, Guzaarish, which wasn't a press screen, but is in number 8 in the top 10. So anyone seen it? A couple of lines would be much appreciated.
Okay, so we do the box office top 10 because Gareth Edwards isn't here. Gareth Edwards is the director and writer and creator of this film, Monsters. Which is coming out next week. So we'll fill the gap with more miracles.
Yes. Simply put.
Yeah, thank you. Miraculous Radio. Not just the flagship film programme, but Miraculous too. Who's this? Matthew Davis in Manchester. I'm a second year student at Holy Cross in Bury,
uh-huh,
with a view to do paleontology at university. And I joined in the national walkout today. We've been he drafted us into the student protests without our permission, he says.
Okay.
It was my first protest, says Matthew.
Excellent.
And all terribly exciting. I was ultimately unprepared, however, and had to make myself a banner at the last minute from an A3 sheet. But what to put? Well, being an avid podcast listener, it just came to me. Hello to Jason Isaacs was written up beneath I'm about to go Kermode, which means on the verge of quite an epic rant. So I'm not sure if that was obviously that you shouldn't have done that, because that might have implied a political opinion one way or the other.
What,
being an old trot, of course.
Yes, exactly. What shouldn't I have done?
No, he shouldn't have done it.
I think it's a bit late to worry about that
Jason
sort of thing, isn't it?
Jason will be fine.
I mean, because Jason's name turned up at the banner to the rally to restore sanity. Was that in Canada?
No, that was in Washington. That was
in Washington.
Yeah,
sorry, sorry, sorry. Yeah, that's John Stewart. That's right. Yes, and there was hello to Jason Isaacs there.
Ellen, previously of Oxfordshire, now Orowa or Oriwa, maybe in New Zealand. Since you seem to be saving lives left, right, and centre, says Ellen, I would like to request that you preemptively save mine, or at least save my boyfriend from having his hand crushed. Okay, so this is a preemptive miracle, because Saint Wittertainment has only just been discussed now for the first time, with proof of our first miracle on the way. Now we're sort of saving people in the future.
I just love the way you're skimming through the waters of blasphemy with such total aplomb.
On Sunday the 28th, I am heading off, says Ellen, to New Zealand. Hello to Jason, he says, to start a new life with a handsome and charming Kiwi. That's the exciting part. I am, however, terrified of flying. The only thing I can think of to pacify and distract me as the plane takes off is a loud dose of Wittertainment. I'll be saving this week's podcast for the purpose, and will be much obliged if you could offer me some soothing words of encouragement to help on my journey.
I know what I can do. I can do my impression of a plane taking off. Want to hear this? You heard this before?
Well,
it's
especially.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
No.
Okay, no special effects. You can see this on thing. An aeroplane taking off.
Is this going to help?
Yeah, well.
Thank you. Oh, what? What happens there? No, sorry, I didn't want any more. No, it's all right. It wasn't that good. It's really, really not that good. It just sounds like you're trying to make someone's bass speaker rattle.
No, it sounds like an aeroplane taking
which
off.
Brought to mind a scene from the Howard Stern movie.
which you're not going to mention.
But if anyone, you know, they would. So at 10, another year. Right, let's do Bob's top 10.
Okay, fine.
Kermode and Mayo's film review. The UK cinema top 10.
Five Live.
Another year. I like
That's what I just said.
Yeah, I know, but then you said something else. Another year. New Mike Leigh film, very good. Four seasons, terrific performances. So, as I said, I was predicting it to win the Cannes Palme d'Or. Didn't. It was beaten by Uncle Boon Me, which is very good. Obviously not in the top 10 because it's a film that's a film that's only playing in lesser cinemas, a lesser number of cinemas, but a lesser cinemas. But I like Another Year.
Do you
year
not mean fewer cinemas?
Much. I do, yes.
Yes.
Ow!
Oh!
Thank you.
Not just in a way with an Arsenal, awful, yes, but a grammar correction on Kermode.
And also, that was terrible, wasn't it? Not a lesser cinema.
Lesser cinemas.
Yes.
It's showing now
it
in
is
lesser cinemas.
Yes.
Dear me.
Okay.
So you started that.
I did. Sorry.
What else do we have? The Social Network at number 9.
I was having a conversation with somebody just before a screening the other day, and I said, we're very near to Oscar season. What are the front runners? And actually, by a process of default, we all figured that actually, sometimes a socialist worker said, actually, if you actually look at what actually happened, you actually find that actually the front runner for best film at the moment may well be Social Network. Because there isn't anything, I mean, there's a very strong body of opinion that Toy Story 3 will get nominated, and it's possible they might give Toy Story 3 the best film in the same way they did with the third Lord of the Rings movie, as kind of a prize for the last three. They, you know, obviously with Godfather, they had won before, and the third one wasn't very good. But so there is a possibility it's going to be Toy Story versus Social Network rather than Toy Story versus Inception. So Social Network, it's funny, it's kind of come from outside as a very strong best film contender. I think it's an interesting film. You liked it, right?
I thought it was fantastic. I want to go again, actually.
Okay, fine.
I think it's excellent. First rate. Gazarish at number 8, but no one has seen it.
Well, somebody will have.
No, no one. We've just done some research.
No one?
No one has actually seen it.
Okay, why is it at number 8, then?
Well, it's clearly a fabrication or just a mistake.
Interesting point that was raised to me. How old do you have to be to go on Facebook?
14, I think. Well, I don't know. I just said 14 because I think I've had that conversation with a 10-year-old close to our family.
12 certificate film. Interesting about Facebook. You're not allowed to go until you're 14.
That interesting. Okay, Alpha and Omega at 7.
Not very interesting. A class war amongst animals. Kind of forgettable animation with a couple of voice cameos, but nothing of any remarkability.
Red is at number 6.
Which when this came out, I said, look, I quite enjoyed this. It was no masterpiece at all, but I quite enjoyed it. I quite liked the idea of, you know, the kind of the oldies getting their own back sort of movie. And there were some very bad reviews of it. But in fact, it's really hung on in there. I mean, it's now been in the top 10 for 6 weeks and it's still at number 6. So it has clearly got an audience. And I mean, it's not a great film by any means, but it is certainly a better film than many of the reviews gave it credit for. And I'm feeling slightly smug that it's done all right.
Jackass 3D at 5.
First 20 minutes of it is laugh out loud funny because that is just people smacking each other in the face with large polystyrene hands and tripping each other over and spilling soup down each other's ties. And I could actually watch that for quite a long time, and I did laugh quite a lot. Once we get beyond that, it gets into somebody tweeted on the Wittertainment site about we were using the word excretions and secretions, and apparently we were using them in the wrong context. That apparently vomiting is vomiting, but all the other things that happen, they've all got different, you know, they're all different. Well, all that stuff, anything with Ishan at the end of it, I don't like. Or ing, ting, itting. I don't like any of that stuff. And there's just far too much of it in 3D.
I would say it's 13 for Facebook.
13?
You need to be 13 to be on Facebook. Okay. So I was worn out. Apologies for that. Skylines at 4. Some correspondence on this.
And is this all correspondence telling me that I was completely wrong and it's a terrible film?
Well, shall we find out?
Yeah.
Dear Doc and Marty, this is from Chris. Allow us to add our voices to the chorus of disappointment for Skyline, a film so poor it managed to make an alien invasion seem boring. It was like Independence Day with all the fun sucked out. The best character in the film and the only one we rooted for was a robot air drone with a nuclear bomb. It was so bad I apologise to everyone for choosing it for us to go and see. Yeah. Dear Doctors, I feel compelled to write hearing the beating that Dr. K took over his review of Skyline a couple of weeks ago, having listened to the howls of indignation over a view describing the film as, to my ears at least, meh, it's all right, I guess, effects good for the budget, I found myself on a dull Sunday afternoon near a world of cine, and I took the plunge. It was, as the good doctor suggested, okay. Yes, both monsters and scenes are lifted wholesale from other movies. Yes, it could lose 10 or 15 minutes in the middle and probably be better for it. There's no shortage of faults, but at the same time, as a reasonably entertaining piece of hokum on a dull afternoon, it was perfectly fine. In summary, it's all right, I guess.
I was interested to read online a review in the Empire Online magazine written by Kim Newman, who I like very much, and somebody with whom I haven't discussed the film. But his verdict on it was almost exactly the same as mine. It was, it's okay. I mean, we've seen a lot worse, and for the money, the special effects are good. It's interesting, though, because we should mention this with Gareth Edwards, because, of course, Monsters cost staggeringly less than Skyline did, and is infinitely better in every way. But I did think Skyline was, seen far, far worse.
I think meh should be on the poster again. I just think that's M-E-H, isn't it?
M-E-H, kind of.
And this from Rob, just a quick defence of Mark's Skyline review. There is no way this is one of the worst films or even sci-fis of the year. It's simply Independence Day from the viewpoint of a Knots Landing cast. TV programme.
Yeah, I know what Knots Landing is.
Great fun after a ponderous first half hour and with some enjoyable effects. Potential spoiler.
Go on.
It's just so people can turn it down.
Okay.
Surely the bizarre ending was tacked on after an LA teens test screening, though. Would that spoil it for anybody?
No, that's fine. Can I just say, on the subject of spoilers, somebody wrote in to say, after all our dancing...
Oh, I've got it.
Oh, you've
got it here, probably making the same point. Is this a Harry Potter point?
Yeah, it is, gone.
Lots of Harry Potter conversation to come in the program, because clearly people can now join in the conversation because they've been able to see it. It's from Dave Powell, MAMSC Bronze Swimming Certificate Honours. About HP7A, given all the hoo-ha about you revealing the unfortunate event... and getting people all hot under the collar about things, this being the last Harry Potter film, and then spending a considerable chunk of your review of HP7A talking about how you shouldn't have revealed the unfortunate event in HP6, and you wouldn't make that mistake again, why did you then choose to play a clip of the film which contains the rather unambiguous line, "It was all in Dumbledore's will. Clunk. I mean, it's not like there's anyone this side of the Dordogne, says Dave, who doesn't know what the unfortunate event was, at least not after you two blabbered it over the radio, but I would have thought you'd have played that one with a little bit more elan. So there you go, so apologies.
What was funny is that neither of us noticed. We were so tied up with worrying about whether we said it, we didn't notice when somebody else said it.
Well, it's quite interesting because in lots of the correspondence for HP7A, a lot of people getting tied up a little bit in not wanting to reveal other unfortunate events. Anyway, we continue. Despicable Me is at 3.
Which is still not particularly remarkable and even less remarkable in 3D. And if you do feel the need to go and see it, the 2D is perfectly fine.
Due Date is at 2.
Which, has been... I mean, Hangover 2 is happening, but it's been described by some people as sort of Hangover 2. And it's the watchable part of it is Robert Downey Jr. I'm still amazed by just how much of a career resurrection Robert Downey Jr. has managed. When you think it wasn't that long ago that he was virtually unemployable because of his rather out-of-control personal life, and yet now he's become a very likeable and clearly quite controlled screen presence. I mean, he has that thing on screen about looking like somebody who's on the edge of madness, which is what he's meant to be in this, which is basically Planes, Trains and Automobiles, but without John Candy and Steve Martin. But there is something quite magnetic about Robert Downey Jr. And if it wasn't for him, I think I would have given up on the film a lot earlier on. It's not great by any means, but there are things in it that are passably laughable.
Number one, of course, and flattening everything else, is the Harry Potter film, which we will discuss, I think, after
the break. Okay.
We've been, and also we spent some time with
Gareth. Gareth,
who's here, so we're going to be talking about monsters in just a moment. The miracle story is true. We have confirmation of that on a text from listener Joe. It is a true story. Hermione is the sister of a friend, who I know my friend was telling me the story last night, so there's proof of the miracle.
Can I just say, I love the fact that on the BBC you just said the story has been verified. We have a text from somebody whose sister knew the person, lived next down the street, so that's...
I think
Saint Wittertainment has officially
been made. on flimsier evidence than that.
I saw a burning bush at the end of my road.
Have we gone Pete and Dud now? Having just joined your programme, says Paul in Ludlow, was Mark making a noise like a boiling kettle? I think Paul, it was closer to that.
No, Paul, it was the sound of an aeroplane taking off.
Mark in Newcastle. Upon hearing Mark's plane impression, I was looking for the exits located here, here and here. And Dave on this, dear Crouch and Defoe, Mark's plane has just sent my Cocker Spaniel apoplectic. That is the kind of noise that drives dogs mad.
I have two dogs. They love it.
Do they?
Yeah, they just love it.
How do you know?
Because they go, Daddy, go to plane.
Right, first of all, your dogs talk and they call you Daddy.
Yeah, what else are they going to call me? Not Mark, that wouldn't be right.
Master.
Oh, sorry. Well, it amounts to the same thing, doesn't it? Like,
you know. Do you see them as your children? So all this time, actually, you've been talking about your kids on air.
I met my dog.
Actually, they're
dogs.
You don't have kids, do you? You just have animals.
Well, children are animals too.
Mark's impression, says Peter, of an aeroplane has just startled my cat, Claude, so much he's run off and hid under the table. Please would Mark reassure Claude that he was only doing an impression of a plane and tell Claude not to be... Now, if you can speak to animals, this would be another example of... in the imminent sanctification. Diane Webb.
No, actually, that can't speak.
So if Claude has moved, let us know. Hamish in Glasgow. If we are to indulge ourselves in extremely irritating corrections of others' grammar, please inform your friend with the gargantuan flappy hands. He might consider asking, may I correct that, rather than can I correct
that?
Yeah,
no, quite right.
A suitable pause would be welcome for you to reply no.
My favourite grammatic... thing at the moment is
your favourite grammatic thing
is, because I was stuck on a train on the way here. It was held up at, you know, it was Reggie Perrin style, you know, delay at Winchester due to wrong kind of ice on the snow or something. And it's that voice that Sonia, you know, the electronic computer voice on the train, Sonia, because you get Sonia nerves, goes, can the guard contact the driver? To which the answer is, yeah, he can. Do you want him to?
Must be tough in your house.
It drives me nuts. Every time, almost as much as the electronic announcement, which says, I am sorry for the delay. You're not sorry, you're a computer. You can apologise for it, but you can't be sorry for it, because unless we've gone through a whole thing and artificial intelligence has been created since I got on at Basingstoke, you're not sorry, you're a machine.
Phil in Doha, Kermode confuses albeit with although. Albeit must be followed by an adjective or adverb. Although is followed by a verbal phrase or full sentence. Be careful in correcting others.
Okay.
Rob Slade says, in regard to and with regard to are both standard English prepositions and synonymous. So there.
Are they synonymous, Simon?
Apparently so. Now, look, at 21 minutes to 3 o'clock, we will do Harry Potter conversation. We'll do new releases conversation. But there is a movie which you need to know about. It's been directed... It's been written by...
Shot.
Well, shot. Anything else that we need to include?
Visual effects. Visual effects. It whispered from over there. Actually, I was deliberately not doing that at the very beginning. I was giving you the full Mike Lee credit before getting on to... Because you said, you know, that you're not primarily a visual effects, but also visual effects. By Gareth Edwards.
Who's joined us.
Hi.
How are you doing, Gareth?
I'm very well, thank you.
Snazzy shirt you have.
You have webcam here, right? So this is not lost on the radio. That's
look,
great.
We can do better than that. We are live streamed.
Great.
That's what it is. That's why the lights are on. I apologise for the heat, by the way.
It's like being back in Mexico, basically, which is where we shot the film. Sorry.
Yes. Right. So before we go into any detail, just explain the story of the film, and then we'll take it a little bit further. So just explain monsters, please, from the beginning.
I'm very bad at this. I think most directors at this point would have it down to a sentence, and it takes me nearly a minute. But it's basically like, the idea was to make a monster movie that begins where most monster movies normally end. If Cloverfield or Godzilla or King Kong is like September 11th, they're moving on from that. Our film's like Afghanistan. It's kind of years down the line, no one cares. There's a place in the world where there are these big monstrous creatures, but it's part of everyday life. People get used to it. And it's essentially the story of a war photographer who's in this area, and he's tasked with getting his boss's daughter back to America. It's all set in Central America. This whole infected zone basically is in Mexico. And so it's like a road movie meets a love story meets a monster movie. See, it took a minute, I told you.
So, Gareth, I went to see your film yesterday. Okay. And it is, I think it's absolutely fantastic, because the phrase that you, if you see written or if you hear, that people have to get rid of from their heads is the low-budget monster film idea, because I think instantly it puts a certain type of monster and a certain type of film in people's minds, and this for not one moment feels like that. Okay. At all. It feels to me like a big budget movie, feels like an expensive film, fantastically acted, and I believed in your infected zone right from the very beginning. There you go. I just wanted to tell you that.
Thank you.
And we should say that the amount that it's made for is it's about £500,000, which is it's a fraction of what that kind of movie would normally cost. I mean, it's a ridiculously small amount of money.
Yeah, I don't actually know the budget. I get this question a lot, and I genuinely don't know. It's kind of
isn't
like
that one of your jobs?
Yeah, you say £500,000. That's what everyone else is saying. Just repeat that figure.
Okay,
so it might be 29 million for all you know.
I think you would have noticed if you'd been spending 29 million, wouldn't you?
I think it was actually 150 million, but we spent 149 million digitally removing all the cast and crew and all the cranes and the Winnebagos from the behind-the-scenes footage.
Now, you reminded me just a few moments ago, and I apologise for not reminding you, of the moment. I have actually interviewed you before on 5 Live when you were talking about a TV show that you were working on with CGI and special effects,
sure.
Which was?
It was Attila the Hun. It was for the BBC. That was kind of... I used to do a lot of visual effects and I'd some directing TV shows for BBC, factual, mm-hmm. not drama. There's a big difference. And that was the last thing I did. And then I managed to somehow get this monster movie off the ground after doing that.
So I think the key thing is here is that gap then between you making that program that you came on 5 Live to tell us about the effects when we were talking television and you now having this monsters film is a huge jump. So it sounds to me as though you didn't wait for someone to go... That guy, Gareth Edwards, he's going to be pretty good. Let's offer him a deal. You just went out there and did it.
It's funny because it might look like a leap up from the outside. Like you watch the film, oh, you've gone and made a movie. That's great. But it was a leap down from the inside. It was essentially, it went from like working at the BBC, you have large crews and cast and, you know, they spend a lot of money and stuff. And suddenly we're in the middle of the jungle in Central America with just a camera, a sound man, two actors. And that was kind of pretty much... you know, predominantly how we shot the whole movie.
And the way you shot it was that you went out, you had a vague sense you had the story plotted out, you had a vague sense of what the characters would say to each other at any particular place, but you would go from location to location, then you would effectively, you'd Mike Lee it, right? You'd improvise it, you'd work it up, because I've seen the notebooks, and it just says, in this scene, it's established that, and that's about it. And then you made the journey across these various locations, doing whatever you could, wherever you could.
I mean, we were really going for the whole realism thing. Like, that, if anything, I wanted the film to feel as realistic as possible. And I feel that in a lot of movies, because the writer literally has months to think about the dialogue, it's so perfect and so expositional that it's not how I talk. It's not like me now trying to figure out what I'm going to say next and being very inarticulate and stuff. And so I wanted the actors to sort of...
be as inarticulate as you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they had to look as stupid as I am, so else it wouldn't feel real. And
but
so
they're great, aren't they?
They're fantastic. Scoot and Whitney, they just started dating when we did the film.
They're married now, right?
Yeah, they got married a few months back. And
I say Scoot and Whitney, that's got to be a made-up. They're not really called that, are they?
Well, the thing is, if you're...
No couple are really Scoot and Whitney.
Yeah, well, Scoot McNair, he's got quite a big CV, isn't he? I mean,
the thing is, you can't be called... his real name's John. But there's a
there
John.
You go.
Right,
there
I'm sorry.
Go.
So he's not called Scoot.
Is John McNeary exists and already sort of registered with SAG or whatever it is, the Actors Union in the States. So you have to come up with a new name because otherwise, everyone would turn up and say the name's Brad Pitt. So you have to have a completely unique name. And because Scoot was his nickname as a kid, he chose that.
If you went to SAG and there was a Simon Mayo, what would you be?
Oh,
you couldn't
know.
Be Simon. Would you be Basher Mayo?
Okay, yeah, fine. I'll be Basher. Yeah, call me Basher.
Basher.
Does that sound better?
I'll be Pop.
No, that is not going to... I'll just call me Saint.
Okay,
Saint. I think that'll work. So where did you find Scoot and Whitney? Because I haven't seen them in anything before.
Scoot was in a film called In Search of Midnight Kiss that was distributed by the same company that produced Monsters.
Which, if you remember, was Film of the Week here on the show, in which I mentioned how good he was.
See, good taste. And then we saw that, but I wanted a real couple, so I sort of... We contacted Scoot, we really liked him, but he said, look, we're looking for a genuine couple because the chemistry is so important in this film. He said, oh, well, don't worry, my girlfriend's an actress. And he sent through her photo, and it was basically like a glamour shoot from like sort of FHM or GQ type magazine. And she's absolutely stunning and gorgeous. And it just really put me off because I was like, I don't want to make that kind of film. That's the kind of Hollywood version of our film. And I wanted to make this sort of gritty, real thing. But then I got to meet her and you sort of realise how ugly she is without Photoshop and makeup and stuff. And no, she's really down to earth and not the person you expect. And so I was just bowled over by them when I met them. And it's just like, okay, well, if I can get these guys on the screen, like then half the problem solved, really.
Monsters is a new film. Gareth Edwards created it. He thought of it. He's filmed it. He's directed it. It's his movie. Ben on this email says, it's great you've got Gareth in because he's doing so well. I was once a finalist against him for the Broadcast Young Visual Effects Artist Award a few years back. We both lost to a 24-year-old that wasn't as talented as either of us. He was just younger. Remember this?
Yeah, I was thinking, oh, I hope he doesn't say I won, because I didn't.
No. Anyway, says Ben, I thought he would be the perfect person to take Mark to task about his anyone can do CGI, it's easy comments, because it's not.
Yeah. Can I clear the
air? Can you backtrack?
No, it's not to do with backtracking.
Can you apologise?
I think I've already covered this. What I said was, ages and ages ago, we were talking about something happened, and I was talking about the preponderance of special effects, and CGI special effects, and I didn't say anyone could do it. I said that there was a point when, if you saw a James Bond movie in which a car flipped over, you realise that somebody's actually flipping a car over. But then we were referring to, it was the apocalyptic movie, the one when the world floods and there's a boat, what is it called, with John... You know,
the
just
Death
recently.
Or 2012.
Anyway, one of them. Anyway, and the plane flies through a hole.
Yes, 2012.
In the 2012 one. And I said, well, yeah, it's not that exciting because I know that none of it's happening. Now, that's not the same as saying anyone can do special effects. But anyway, a bunch of people wrote in, and I did then say on the program, you're quite right. There is great artistry in special effects, there's good special effects and bad special effects. All I meant was, there was something in the physical world when you actually dropped a car out of a building without anyone getting hurt. That was, even if it didn't particularly move the thing on it, was just the, oh, there it is physically. Now, actually, what's interesting about Monsters is that all the special effects for Monsters were done in Gareth's bedroom. I mean, I did a piece about this on the Cult Show last night, and Gareth was there showing me on his computer how you do it. And to some extent, it is apparent that we've reached a tipping point with software, that it is now at least theoretically possible for people without access to millions and millions of dollars to do something interesting with special effects. So you no longer have to have a film with a guy in a mask or a plastic dinosaur. But that doesn't mean they can do it. Just having the tools isn't enough. In the past, it simply wasn't possible. I mean, I know that your feeling is that this has been possible for longer than I think it has. But I think we have reached a tipping point where it is now at least possible for people to attempt to make a movie like Monsters. I think the fact that you've done it as well as you have, that's something that not everyone could do. But the technology has brought us to a point when somebody in their bedroom can at least have a go.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because everyone sort of acts a little bit surprised when you explain how you did all the visual effects, but I'm surprised that people are surprised. It's like everybody, when you look at those movies like 2012 or whatever film you want to pick on, do you know, drumroll, do you know how they're created? It's like they're a guy on a computer at a desk somewhere, and that desk could be in a massive Soho facility or somewhere in Los Angeles, or it could be in your bedroom. It's still a computer. It's still a person on a keyboard and a mouse, or, you know, a graphics tablet or something. It's the same process completely, and it's just, and I think as a visual effects person, like, there are lots of, probably listen to this now, they've been sitting there itching to be allowed to, you know, the possibility of making a film for a long time, and no one gives them that, you know, basically it becomes a difficult situation to get out of. But because of the breakthrough, I'd say the biggest breakthrough really is with the cameras, in that now, you know these Canons, you know, the DSLRs, basically you can shoot high definition, which is cinema resolution, on a stills camera, like, you know, the Canon 5D is the one that everyone seems to have. And it's like, so people on holiday now,
so a few hundred pounds,
it's about 1,500, okay. I think, but it's still like a film camera used to be £100,000 or so.
So I wonder if people will take from that, not just budding directors and budding special effects people, but also actors and actresses, thinking, maybe I could learn from this. I'm not going to wait to be offered something. I'm not going to wait for a studio to call me up and say, I'd like your work, let's work together. That maybe as this technology gets cheaper, just go out and do it. Just go out, make something, film something. You can film it to fantastic quality. If you're good, put it out there. Let's see what happens.
For sure. I mean, that's what we did, really. It was kind of the idea that no one was ever going to come along and just give us like £1 million or whatever it was to go make a film. It was essentially like, I mean, I've been trying to do this since I was at film school, so it feels like I thought back in 1996 when I graduated that it would take me 6 months to figure out how to use this software and then try and make a movie on a home computer type thing. And a decade went past and I still hadn't done it. And I just felt like around the world there were thousands of other people learning this stuff and they were all going to beat me to it, and there's going to be hundreds of films being made by guys in their bedroom type things. And I've been surprised how few there have been, basically. And I hope, if anything, the film inspires people to just pick up a camera and go make a movie, because it's certainly kind of worked out for us.
As far as the content of the film, I think what's interesting about the monsters in the film is, I can't remember, maybe there are other films that do this, but almost every monster film starts with damage caused by monsters, a little glimpse of maybe the monster's left ear, but you never see it, you know, till the final big resolution. There's the monster doing his thing, and there's a helicopter attacking it. Right,
and it's on screen for 3 seconds before it gets blown up by an atom.
Yeah, and often when you see the big reveal of the monster, oh, that's a bit disappointing. It looks like a fish, or it looks like, you know, a dog, or something like that. Your monsters, right from the very, you see them all. You see them on television. You see what they can do. You see what they look like.
But crucially, you see them in the background. I mean, the thing that's almost the most striking.
But they're just on.
Yeah, exactly. That's the whole point. It's not like, oh, look, they're there. It's exactly as you were saying. They're just there. And that's the really interesting thing about the film, is it looks like an independently spirited film about two people on a road trip across this strange landscape that happens to have massive monsters in the background. That's what's remarkable, isn't it?
Well, it's funny. I only realised this recently, but I think the reason I was so attracted to that concept was because, like, you do visual effects for a living, and everyone points at the screen and goes, "Oh my God, look at that! How did you do that? That's magic, and that's amazing." And you're kind of bored of it because for the last 10 years, that's all I've been doing, you know, every single day. And it's a bit like the characters in our film; they're kind of bored of these creatures. They've been living with them for 10 years or whatever it's been, and so they don't, like, they walk into a motel. One of my favourite bits is they walk into a motel, switch on the TV, you get this sort of CNN type War of the Worlds situation, and it cuts back to their reaction. In any other film, they'd be like, "Oh my God, look what's happened," but instead they sort of yawn and pour a glass of water and have some mundane conversation about something else, because I feel like that's how I react now when I walk home into my bedroom and there's something about Iraq on the news. I've seen it too many times and I don't care, and it feels like something's only extraordinary by definition for a short amount of time, and then it becomes ordinary again. And so I found that, A, it was a lot cheaper to do because I don't need to pay all these extras to just carry on with their lives. And B, it felt more of an interesting place to set a monster movie in, where everyone just, there's no running and screaming. It's like, it's part of everyday life, you know.
And was it just me, or were there some references to sort of Americans' attitude to immigration in there as well?
There is a metaphor in there. I think all science fiction is sort of metaphorical in a way. The one I was going for was more about the war on terror, in that, without getting too political, but it's like, yes, there are monsters in the world. They do kill people, but at what price is it worth eradicating them? If you kill more innocent people getting rid of the monsters than the monsters could ever kill, is it still worth doing, type thing? But because I set the film in Mexico with a giant wall and people on a journey back to America and these things called aliens, you know, everyone reads into this whole immigration thing. But that was just a happy accident, basically, from where we set it.
This from Sally: the girls at Cartmel College, well, three of us at Lancaster University, can see you all on the live stream. We think Gareth is super hot.
No, that's because the studio, because it's sweltering in it. Yeah. He's not. He is. I mean, he's genuinely super hot, but we all are.
Yeah, but they're actually making a reference, I think, to his gorgeousness.
Yeah, that's because he's half our age. I was that good looking when I was, what, are you 12?
I'm 11 and three quarters.
There we go.
So
Simon's 65.
That's right. I, yeah, the thing is, I've been lying about my age for ages. I've been 65 for 10 years.
that's like let the right one in, isn't it? How old are you? I'm 65, but I've been 65.
I wasn't going to read this out, but the text concludes from Sally: Mark, have you put on weight? There you go. I wasn't going to read that. But as you said, you're 64.
Go on and finish it off. And when did you go so grey?
What did you
answer?
What you,
last few months.
What are you working on next, Gareth?
I've been very lucky. I've got a development deal. There's a Russian filmmaker called Timur Bekmambetov who's
Night Watch, Day Watch.
Yes, and he was a big fan of monsters, and he's very politely financing me to make my next film, which is a science fiction. And the tagline, which real fast, is an epic human story set in a futuristic world without humanity. So it's really vague and annoying.
Gareth Edwards, thank you. Monsters is terrific. Thanks for coming.
Thanks.
Reviews to come in this hour of the following films.
The American, Machete, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, Leapy Ear, not that one, and more.
We promised you some Harry Potter conversation because we did the box office top 10 while waiting for the great Gareth Edwards to join us. So we've done the box office top 10. If you've missed it, you can listen again on iPlayer, or you can download the podcast, which will be available pretty much as soon as we're finished. But some Harry Potter conversation now that you've actually had a chance to go and see it, led here by Simon Dennis in Wetherby. Went to see HP7A while you were on air on Friday. I am listening again as I type. I very much like the animated Three Brothers tale, the trio rambling. Got a little too rambly at times. I felt we could have had a little less tent time and an extra set piece on which to end. Although the unfortunate elf-based event was done well. So can we do that? Can we refer to an unfortunate elf-based event, or would that would that be too much?
Well,
of a
can
spoiler?
I just say you've just done it twice, so it's really not. I mean, the problem with all this is that, in a way, since HP7A ends halfway through the story, one could legitimately argue that the whole plot is up for grabs because it's the setup. It is the setup for HP7B.
Indeed.
And also, I think, but we have, we have tried as much as possible not to give details away. Certainly in the screening that we were in, that you and I were in, it wasn't any surprise to anyone that the unfortunate elf-based event was occurring. The question was simply whether that was where the film was going to end. And as you said at the time, there was a sense that when the film did end, although we had been there for a while because it's not short, that there were some people going, is that it? Is that where we're ending? I mean, I had thought that was the only natural break in the story. I mean, it's interesting. I was reading The Hobbit again the other day, and I don't like The Hobbit very much, but there is a bit in the middle of it which is clearly where Hobbit 1A is going to end.
Hobbit 1A?
Well, it's going to be Hobbit 1 and Hobbit...
One and 2 would probably suffice.
1 and 2. So it's only because of the HP7A thing. That's...
Matt in Halifax... went to see HP7A today at my not-so-local multiplex of Ultimate Suffering. Despite the fact that I cannot fault the acting, directing, cinematography, effects, music, etc., I came away disappointed. I have been left with the feeling that what I have seen is not part one of a two-part adaptation, but rather the first half of a four-and-a-half-hour film. It may well be a subtle difference, but I think it's an important one. It was like watching a film on TV that breaks halfway through for a special six-month-long edition of The News at 10. Which is kind of what I was trying to say last week.
I mean,
Matt
says
it better.
Yeah, I disagree. I think it does feel like a coherent whole, but I know people feel differently about it. And I'm wondering whether, when the two are out, whether they'll be put together as a single film. You know, there was the whole thing about Kill Bill 1 and 2 actually being Kill Bill. And were they ever reunited on DVD? I believe, maybe wrongly, that Kill Bill became a single entity in some format, some home viewing format. Then again, I mean, bear in mind, Godfather 1 and 2 became a TV production in which they straightened all the narrative out, which was insane, and made it into one story, which went across three videotapes in Days of Yore. So,
Dominic in Sydney, Harry Potter 7A was by no means disappointing. The acting, writing and cinematography were consistently engaging and enjoyable. Two problems. Firstly, the entire midsection of the film comprised of Harry and company travelling cross-country was too slow for my taste. I appreciate that the filmmakers are taking time to breathe in this two-part construct, a welcome contrast to the breakneck speed of other previous films. I think that they simply took this too far. Secondly, I remember reading about David Yates' desire to use more handheld cameras in this instalment as a means of elevating tension and hoping that he would do this without reason. Sadly, he stumbles during a tense chase sequence, jerking the camera frame around until we have no idea who or what we're looking at.
Okay.
Here's an interesting thing, if I can find it. There's so many emails about this.
Then can I just say, just to queue up, we'll start with the American, if that's all right.
Who are you talking to?
Just saying to get the clips queued up.
Should you not have said that during the news?
I would have said it during the news, but I was too busy doing other things.
Dear Dobby and Creature, says Alistair, what is the good doctor's take on the multitude of reviews which are saying a film must be taken on its own merits, and on that basis it doesn't add up or doesn't stand up? Surely this film, as in Deathly Hallows, is unique, almost unique, in being a seventh part, a film so totally dependent on seeing the other movies and possibly even having read the books. It is, says Alistair, one of the least standalone movies ever.
I think it is certainly true that it has to be judged both on its own merits and within the context of the other films. We did say quite clearly, if you've never seen any of the other Harry Potter films, don't start with part seven because it won't make any sense. I was quite pleased by the fact that they did very little Basil expositioning. But obviously, it's not a previously on Harry Potter moment. I mean, there are precedents to some extent. If you look at Battle for the Planet of the Apes, there was an argument about whether or not that film had any merit on its own if you hadn't seen everything else. Well, because I saw Battle for the Planet of the Apes first, and that was the thing that then led me on to watch the other apes, because there's five official apes movies, of which Beneath the Planet of the Apes is the best one. But they only fully make sense in connection with each other. I think as far as Harry Potter 7 is concerned, it is legitimate for it to only fully work in connection with the other films. I mean, otherwise, how would you have any idea what's going on? You said this yourself, didn't you? If you haven't seen the other, nobody does.
Don't start
that.
Here. No, there's absolutely
I was quite surprised to discover when you read the Harry Potter books again that actually at least the first three of them begin with a recap of where, in case you didn't read the other ones. The first thing they begin, like, Harry Potter had discovered that he was a wizard. You know, which is obviously, like, if you hadn't read the previous ones, just to get you up to speed. So I was surprised.
But by the time you get to seven, there really is...
They've given up doing that. It's like, you know, read the other books.
Ross Gick says, after listening to your review for HP7A on the podcast, I was unsure of what to expect. Mark raved about it. Simon saying it dragged and needed to be one film. I don't think I said it. I did think the first part did. Yeah. And then as soon as they get to Godric's Hollow, I thought it was very good. Anyway, I must say, says Ross, there are very few 2.5-hour films that absorb me so much that it feels like a shorter film. This is most definitely one of them. Simon, you're just plain wrong. The story is so engrossing that when the final scene came, I could not believe that it was finished. And what a final scene it was. Can't wait for the next one. As for the acting, I've never been convinced by Daniel Radcliffe. When you have dialogue about any sci-fi or fantasy subjects, there are just some actors who cannot pull it off believably. The young lady who played Martha Jones in Doctor Who being one of them. But even so, it did not put me off the film, as Rupert Grint and Emma Watson were simply superb. Tom in Haringey. I was wondering what the good doctors, and he's put the apostrophe in the right place, so that means both of us, thought of a particularly emotional moment towards the end of the latest HP film involving a certain CGI character. In said event, I struggled to fight back the tears, but felt I had to, not only because I'm a boy and boys don't cry, should be a song about that, but also because I didn't feel I should be getting upset about a computer graphic. Yet as much as I kept silently repeating the mantra, it's not real, it's not real, I couldn't help but feel it was. In certain respects.
And of course it is real because it is Toby Jones. I mean, it's not just a computer graphic. It is what, you know, it's mocap or whatever we're now calling it. And in fact, let's take this moment to just say, you know, congratulations to Toby Jones for conjuring a very, very believable character with the, with the use of, I mean, he didn't do the CGI himself, but it's like Andy Serkis and with Gollum. I think there was another tipping point there. Certainly for me, as I remember saying, how can Andy Serkis be Gollum? Gollum is a special effect. And then actually having to get my head around the whole thing about mocap, and I was completely wrong before. And I do think that motion capture, when done properly, is every bit as much acting as Robert De Niro going, you know, you're looking at me, you're looking at me.
Jessica in Singapore. Dear Dr. Mum and Dr. Dad, with the kids safely in school, I skived off the housework to visit my local cinema. I spent some quality time with Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. In Singapore, you have to know your cinema code of conduct, see last week's programme, is more like a how-to rather than a what not to do. And I am consequently rather accustomed to crunching, munching, texting and inappropriate giggling and seat-kicking. However, nothing quite prepared me for the bunch of rowdy students who infiltrated what I hoped would be a quiet 11 a.m. screening on a Wednesday. Upon entering the cinema, one girl loudly inquired, "Is there Wi-Fi in here?" And I think you can probably guess how the rest of the screening went, behaviour-wise.
That's top of the list of things you don't want to hear as the lights go down.
I apologise to the person who sent in an email who said, with reference to the code of conduct and the 10 things that you know, the way to behave, that's all true, apart from if you go to a Bollywood film, in which case do all 10 at the same time.
No, somebody else said that to me. We ought to have put that's exactly right. Do you want to apologise to me for calling me fat?
I didn't. It was a text from a listener.
It called me fat.
And I wasn't going to read it out until you said I'm 64.
Oh, I see. Fine. So I called you old and you called me fat, as long as I understand how that worked.
It's that kind of childishness which I think has made this the BBC's...
The marriage worked so long.
...flagship film programme. Okay. Teresa Redway couldn't listen live, so I got the benefit of your review via the podcast. Son was appalled. This is going to see Harry Potter 7-8 family event. Son was as appalled by me mouthing hello to Jason Isaacs at the appropriate moment as I was by the behaviour of the couple next to him. Noisy food and drink, toilet visits and phone lighting up all the time. I will equip myself with postcard-sized copies of the rules for future visits. Husband was as near to silent as he has ever managed. He's often an embarrassment to us, making us reluctant to make him. Anyway, Teresa also continues, Mark's review was spot on. Simon's preference to have 3 hours of the whole thing is just wrong, in capital letters. This is Five Live. The American is the new George Clooney movie.
So with the, with this poster, which is a very kind of...
What poster?
I'm holding it up here. I'm holding it up for you to look at and also for people who can see
live
on the webcam.
Streamed. But describe it for those who just...
Well, yeah, it's basically... Thing. What I was going to say was it looks like a deliberately throwback poster. It looks like the kind of poster you'd have for like a 60s thriller, like an Antonioni movie, for example. It has George Clooney in a suit holding a gun, running in a semi sort of James Bond style against a block orange background with an eye.
It's very Bond.
But everything... It is... Well, it's... I think it's slightly more arty than Bond. Do you think it's Bond? Bond would usually be like an image of a man with exploding boats and a woman in a bikini. That looks much more to me...
1965.
Okay, fine. So it's directed by Anton Corbijn, who really caught everyone's eye with Control, the film about the evolution of Joy Division, and who made his name originally as a rock photographer and a rock video maker. When he came on the programme... And he was sort of, he was odd because he's Dutch, and he was slightly chippy about whether or not we were saying that being a rock video, it's funny, people come out of rock videos and they worry that therefore their work will be taken less seriously, that somehow saying that somebody came from rock videos is a bad thing. Actually, that's not true at all. I mean, the two great paths into filmmaking at the moment, other than short films, are advertising and rock videos. I mean, loads and loads of people have come through that. Anyway, so the story is, which is based on a book, which is a very private gentleman. In the book, the lead character here, played by George Clooney, is an Englishman. Anton Corbijn said that he changed it specifically to an American because he wanted to work with an American actor, and obviously the American actor he's got is George Clooney. The story is George Clooney is not a hitman. He's been referred to in many places as a hitman, but he's not a hitman. He appears to be a weapons expert, somebody who specialises in the craft of making and facilitating, you know, specialist weapons. At the very, very beginning of the movie, we see him in what looks like a kind of James Bond post-mission thing, in which he's in front of a roaring log fire with a glamorous woman. And then very, very, very near the beginning of the movie, something shocking happens, which we shan't give away.
An unfortunate event.
An unfortunate, yes, but unfortunate, but quite deliberate event. And he then has to go on the run and hole up in a remote village where he has to, in the manner of these things, has to wait. On the one hand, he has a job that he has to do, which is to do with the creation of a new weapon, a specific weapon for a specific job. On the other hand, he has to lie low. Now, this is a well-worn trait of this particular form of thriller. As a guy who's done something, has to run away from it, has to go into... I mean, actually, you can see it in things as varied as Witness, for example, you know, in which the whole idea is you take somebody, put them in a completely foreign location where they have to blend in with the community and what's going to happen while simultaneously waiting for the bad guys to turn up or for their superiors to come and tell them what it is they have to do. Whilst he is waiting, he is given this new job of assembling a new weapon, and he has these strange meetings with a woman of no fixed hairstyle, who every time she appears to be slightly different, but who gives him instructions on what is required. Here is the particularly kind of clipped dialogue when his mission is first explained to him.
I'm Edward.
Matilda.
Range?
150 to 175 metres.
Time?
5 seconds, 7 at the most.
Target?
1.
Firing rate?
Rapid.
Magazine capacity?
Large. Preferably a 5.56. The weapon must be fairly light and compact.
How compact?
As compact as possible.
Want an automatic rifle to fit inside a woman's purse?
A small vanity case would be permissible.
A small briefcase would be possible. Noise?
Silencer.
I can only give you a suppressor. It'll dampen the decibels and dislocate the sound source. Reduce the muzzle flash. Can't make you silent, but I can make you invisible as long as you're willing to lose some range. 2 o'clock. Light blue shirt, sunglasses. Is he with you?
I didn't see him. In any case, I'm alone.
So, George Clooney is American. The action starts in Sweden, then goes to Italy. So, I mean, it is a truly sort of international endeavour. Here are the things that are interesting about the American. I have to say from the beginning, I don't think it's as good a movie as Control. And that may be a narrative thing. It may be that I think Control was quite remarkable in as much as somebody who's not a huge Joy Division fan, I really felt that Control did something interesting with the rock biopic beyond just the visuals. The most obvious thing to say about The American is that it looks beautiful. I mean, unsurprisingly, Anton Corbijn has a terrific eye, as does his cameraman, and the whole film, you know, positively glows off the screen. In fact, it's designed to within an inch of its life sometimes. The moments at which it works best are the still moments. There are compositions, there are shot compositions, which, I mean, they are really genuinely, you know, beautifully photographed, and that's terrific. The other thing is that there is a great interest in the film in watching George Clooney assembling the weapon that he has been told in that conversation to make. It's a funny thing about cinema, about craftsmanship. You know, people crafting things on screen is a peculiarly seductive procedure. There's many movies in which you see, I mean, even when you see, you know, it's a very militarized thing, you know, people putting guns together on screen, and on one level it's a really horrible thing, and yet cinema somehow really loves the idea of putting things together, you know, making clocks, making watches, making devices. And
Colin Firth getting dressed.
Well, actually, yes.
That's a very good...
Yeah.
10 minutes to assemble all his cufflinks and collars. It's the same kind of process.
It is, exactly. And it's the thing about, you know, the cufflink will fit through perfectly and then it clicks and, you know, and or, for example, at the beginning of Up in the Air or even in the Ocean's 11, 12 movies, people packing and clipping suitcases and flipping things. There's something very satisfying about that process, and there is something very satisfying in The American about seeing the craftsmanship of what's going on. George Clooney's character is clearly influenced by the character of Michael Clayton. In fact, when Anton Corbijn was on the show, he said precisely that what he did was he said to Clooney, I want you to do that, only more so. The idea that Michael Clayton is somehow completely closed off from the world. And actually, that's a role which he also partly parlayed in Up in the Air, the idea of somebody who's, you know, he's not warm, he's not cuddly, he's not nice, he's actually shut down, he's emotionally isolated. Now, I would say that the obvious references for the film, but a lot of people have referred to Paolo Sorrentino's Consequences of Love. I mean, obviously, Antonioni is the passenger to some extent. When Corbyn was in here, I said, well, clearly the thing that it owes the greatest debt to is Le Samurai, which at which point, of course, Corbyn said, yes, well, everyone says that, but I haven't seen it, nor indeed was I aware of the film. In a way, it doesn't matter. Obviously, he's kind of somehow by a process of osmosis of being in a world, a cinema world, in which that film is out there, he's somehow absorbed it. It'll be remarkable when he sees Le Samurai to see how many comparisons there are, in the same way that the guys who made the Blair Witch Project had never seen Cannibal Holocaust and then were shocked when they saw it. Go, yes, actually, that is exactly the same sort of principal idea. However, the key to it is that Corbyn himself said that it has nods to Sergio Leone and Westerns. And he said it's a very Western movie idea. The idea that the guy does something, he has to go off to a small town where he has to lie low, but somebody's coming, and in the end there's going to be a big confrontation. And in a way, that is also the key to the things that are less satisfying about the movie. The less satisfying things are the fact that it's riddled with cliche. The idea of the lone, not a hitman, but the lone guy who's, you know, outside of the law, arriving in a village where the spiritual and the physical are represented quite literally by a priest and a prostitute. It's like, we're not actually working outside the box very hard there, are we? So he goes
like
to
a Vickers and Tarts party.
A Vickers and Tarts, exactly. He goes to an Italian Vickers and Tarts party, and he talks to the vicar about, you know, is there anything, a life after death? And then he goes to the Tarts part of the party, and then we can fill it.
Wouldn't want to confuse the two.
He wouldn't want to, really. Although actually, of course, the way that the film works is that, of course, they are in fact two sides of the same thing, aren't they? And the progress of his character, who starts off being isolated, and yet through relationship with the priest and the prostitute, actually discovers connections with the world that perhaps you wouldn't have expected, but of course you do expect completely, because that's the way these stories pan out, is extremely cliched. If there is a great value in the film, it's that it takes a situation that is so cliched, that is so hackneyed, that is so overworked, that is so predictable, and yet manages to breathe life into it through its stylishness, through the fact that it is shot in such an interesting way, through the fact that George Clooney does that shut down guy on his own rather well, and is so, it's not just that he's photogenic, he's, the camera loves George Clooney, and there's something about him, the camera can look at him for a very long time doing very little, and somehow it is still a cinematic spectacle. So in a way, what it is it's a collection of cliches, it's a collection of ideas put together, of which the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. I kind of, in the end, I enjoyed it and I liked it and I was impressed by it, but I do think it's cliched, I do think it's hackneyed, I do think it's not a masterpiece by any means, and it's certainly not groundbreaking in the way that Control was. Your feeling?
The gun construction sequence of which you're talking about,
yeah,
reminded me, and I enjoyed it actually.
Did you basically agree with what
I do? I do basically agree with everything that you said.
No,
I do.
All fatuousness aside, seriously, yes.
Was I being fatuous?
No.
Did it sound fatuous? No. You know the Stella Artois adverts, and I mentioned them specifically. The adverts for that, it's on television.
Other beers are available.
But it's that particular, the way they kind of lovingly create at great length this particular,
yes, yeah, yeah.
The hops and the coldness and the condensation, and you know, no other beer is. You know, that's what they're trying to
say. Although many other beers probably are.
But it takes forever to do, and isn't this a lovely work of art that we've created? And all that kind of, that's what it is. It's basically a Stella Artois advert, except it's
with
a
guns
gun rather than a beer, and therefore should be treated very carefully. But I think Clooney is fantastic in it. I mean, he's just watchable in absolutely anything.
You were quite struck by how full-on the sex scenes were.
Well, it was a point to ask Anton Corbijn, because he said in the European tradition there's more nudity. In fact, there's an email on that. So he's quite comfortable with it, you know, he being Dutch and all.
Dutch.
This is Pamela. I'm sure I heard some advanced publicity suggesting that there's some male full frontal nudity in the American. We're undecided about going to the cinema rather than waiting for the TV version, but we might go if it's George with Mr. Happy. And I, as far as I recall, it's not. It's
no. It's not. It's not front bottom, it's back bottom.
It is. It's George's back bottom and a lady's.
Thank you very much.
Bottom.
Yes, there we are.
That's the way it goes.
But in general, was your feeling about it the same as mine was?
I thought it was good, it was enjoyable, but certainly
not groundbreaking. And it is cliche ridden, isn't it?
I prefer monsters, but I thought it was a good George Clooney film.
Okay.
Vic in Madrid, question about the American, without trying to give it away. Don't they have police in Italy? Question number one. Second point, surely a town with a brothel would have a payphone somewhere.
Yeah. And also, It is true that for what's a very small... It's not a town, it's a village. For a village, it is extraordinarily well-served in almost every department.
Lewis on this says, went to see The American after being drawn in by the Action Fest trailer.
Oh, really?
I armed myself with a gallon of Coke and a tray of extra crispy nachos. Sorry, left my Wittertainment code of conduct at home. My experience is best described in the same way as one reviewer stated, what a pretentious Euro snore. It really should have a fraud prosecution for any marketer who calls it a thriller.
Yeah, it's not. It's an existential thriller. That's why I refer you specifically to Le Samurai. It's exactly the same thing. If there is a thrill, it's internal rather than external.
Okay,
because it's about him wrestling with his personal demons, right, as opposed to him actually going out and doing action stuff.
David Harrison in Saint-Sulpice de Favier. Says, I detect that Mrs. Dale is... It says, dear Doctor and Mrs. Dale, I detect that Mrs. Dale is going to say that this film is good. It's actually rubbish. Like a classic French film where nothing happens but long silences, supposedly meaningful. It's full of hackneyed clichés
and is
worthless. Nigel Andrews' review in the Financial Times describes it superbly, which he didn't include, so I can't quote from it.
No, I don't think it is worthless, nor do I think it's rubbish, but I think it is riddled with cliché, and I think the interest that it has is managing to wring some interest out of what is essentially such a well-worn story. I mean, the shots of his glamorous lady folk, you know, running around. There are moments in it when you think bilitis. You know, it's certainly not something in which originality is high on the agenda. But that's why I started by referring to that poster, because it's almost like you know all these films. It's kind of an homage to them.
Warren on this text saw The American in Singapore last month, thought it was a really good watch, lovely to look at, some good tense moments, interesting relationships. It was also fascinating to see the weapon being assembled with a collection of basic hand tools, and George is great. And if you love George, you're not going to be disappointed. Because it is
all George, isn't it?
It lingers.
It does linger longer does. On George.
Leonardo Mogado in Birmingham describes, it's a long email about Harry Potter, he describes Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows as feeling like a Prince's Trust camping expedition that had been organised by Franz Kafka, which I think is an interesting take on it. Thank you for that. And this from Peter in Milton Keynes, Peter Bagley. My wife and I took our 14-year-old daughter to see HP7A on Saturday night at our local multiplex. The film ticked all the boxes, didn't disappoint in front of an enthusiastic audience. One odd feature of the screening, though, the house lights did not really dim throughout the showing. That is, the side lights were off, but the overhead lights were on, and the room was far from dark. Emboldened by Dr. Kay's encouragement, I waited until the titles rolled and quickly nipped out to inform the management. A chap did come in and look at the lights, but no action was taken and the atmosphere was more than a little lost. At the end of the film, my wife sought out the manager to complain. We were placated with free tickets, and the manager explained, "It's all digital. The lights are controlled by the software that comes with the film. We have no control. We'll take a look at the programming." Really, says Peter. First no projectionist, and now the cinema can't control the lights. Perhaps Warner Brothers thought that they would relieve some of the tension by leaving the lights on.
Unbelievable.
I had no idea that actually the software that comes with the movie can then actually control what's happening in the cinema.
Never heard that. It's just absurd. Absurd.
Is that believable?
I mean, everything's believable, but it's absurd.
Peter, thank you very much indeed. It could well be that the manager's got it wrong.
It may be.
He just couldn't be bothered to turn them on. Anyway, we will find out. That's worth a little investigation, which you could do maybe later.
I will do.
Okay, so also out this week.
So, a couple of films. So, London Boulevard, which is a sort of London thriller directed by William Monaghan, who won the Oscar for writing the screenplay of The Departed, Martin Scorsese's remake of Infernal Affairs 1 and 2, in fact. Very loosely based on a book by Ken Bruin, which itself is a sort of pastiche of Sunset Boulevard. You remember the whole thing with Sunset Boulevard is it's, you know, young guy holds up on Sunset Boulevard in the home of an actress, a past it actress, who does the whole thing, but it's not me, that, you know, I'm still big, the pictures that got small. So what you have in Sunset Boulevard, famously narrated from beyond the grave. So what you have here is the similarity is that Colin Firth is the young guy who's just out of prison, trying to go straight, immediately falls into the company of people who are trying to get him not to go straight, most notably Ray Winston's crime boss. Ray Winston acting with his hair, his beard, and his glasses. And finding himself a job looking after Keira Knightley, who plays the, obviously, not over the hill, but very, very reclusive star, who is completely holed into her apartment because she's surrounded by paparazzi who are taking photographs of her and, you know, from whose prying eyes she is attempting to escape. And there is a sort of uneasy bond formed between Colin Firth's character and Keira Knightley's character. Meanwhile, other forces are closing in because there's a subplot about the fact that a very good friend of Colin Firth's character, seller of The Big Issue, has been killed and he wants vengeance for that, although he still wants to remain on the straight and narrow. Meanwhile, Ray Winston wants him to work for him. So the idea of, can he stay on the straight and narrow? Can he find himself a new purpose in life?
I think you say Colin Firth, by the way.
What did I say? Oh, sorry, Colin Farrell.
It's Colin Farrell.
Sorry, this just, well, as you can tell from that description, there is a superfluity of plot. There is basically, you know, a central line, which is he's trying to go straight and he's trying to find a new life, but all these things from the outside are preventing that from happening. And the other thing is that it's a movie which again, very much like The American, it refers to a number of other movies. Some people have said, for example, that it has a kind of crime capery feel in the manner of the Michael Caine movies. I mean, I think the thing it most obviously relates to is performance, because it's the idea of the rock star and the gangsters holed up in a sort of London tenement where everything is, you know, everything is falling apart and where the lines between stardom and criminality are falling apart. On the good side, we have a very, very good and very funny performance by David Thewlis, who plays this kind of washed up actor.
He's absolutely brilliant.
Isn't he? And he gets...
enjoying every second.
He gets the best line in the movie, which I shan't repeat, because I don't want to spoil it, and also because I don't think we could sort of decently say it here, but he does that thing. I mean, there are very few people who can roll a line around their mouth like David Thewlis, and it's not just rolled away, it's like you can see the line rolling around inside his head before he actually delivers it. And it's a wonderfully kind of reptilian sort of fey physical bedraggled, you know, I was an actor and then for a while I was on methadone and then I became a producer, which he makes the most of it. So the main joys of the film are the incidental moments. That Eddie Marsden is terrific in a fairly small role, but again, Eddie Marsden does what he does really well. Keira Knightley actually is pretty well cast. I mean, it seems to me the key to Keira Knightley being good is to do with her casting roles which play to her strengths. She was very good in The Duchess. Actually, she's very good in this as the terrified starlet who's, you know, been sort of shut into her house by this stardom which has happened to her, and obviously at a very, very young age, and which has made her completely reclusive. And I thought she handled it pretty well, particularly since there are some lines she has to deliver which are fairly ropey, including a line when she says, you know, what would you do if I told you that I might have fallen in love with you a little bit last night, which is the kind of thing which if you were script editing, you just go, nope, she does not say that. The camera tells you what you need to know about that. All in all, the funniest thing about it is that there is this from the producer, which I thought was lovely. He says, he's talking about William Monaghan doing it. He says, the film accurately captures the raw testosterone-fueled world of British crime syndicates right down to the nuances of their accents. according to the UK Born. Well, actually, if you had to have the movie up on one thing, it would be that there is a little sort of Tower of Babel-like thing going on with the accents. Actually, I thought Colin Firth's London accent was perfectly acceptable.
Colin Farrell.
Oh, sorry, I'm going to do it all the way through. Colin Firth's accent was fine. Colin Farrell's accent was a little bit every now and then. But actually, I thought he generally did a pretty good job. And certainly, all the time I was watching it, I thought it was stylish and it was interesting. It was very much a tourist view of London. It didn't feel at all like, actually...
Not many tourists outside Pentonville Prison.
No, I don't mean tourists as in tourist. I mean tourists as in it's an outsider's view, it's a glamorised view of London. Actually, it's not a realistic portrayal of the, you know, of London's crime syndicates. It's a realistic portrayal of London's crime syndicates as portrayed in those kind of movies. And again, like The American, it has a sort of throwback nostalgic thing to it.
And the music certainly underlines, because the music sounds though it's a 60s thing anyway.
Yes, and as do the graphics in the opening and closing credits. They're sort of saying to you, it's this kind of movie, it's that kind of movie. You know, it's movie related as opposed to, it has nothing to do with reality. I mean, I don't believe in any of these characters in the real world. Ray Winston is playing a movie crime boss. Colin Farrell is playing a movie ex-con. Keira Knightley is playing a movie star. And oddly enough, that might be why she's so good, because her character is closest to the real world than anything else. It is, in the end, incidental. I don't think it's a great piece of work by any means, but I kind of enjoyed it while it was there, and I thought it didn't bottle out at the end. Your own feeling?
Colin Farrell's accent is pretty good. Only trouble with it is when Ray Winston turns up, you go, that's what a London accent. That's what you sound like if you're a gangster.
Again, it's like something, you know, if you see Ray Winston in the Mel Gibson movie recently, when Ray Winston was doing Boston, I'm sure if you came from Boston, you'd go, hang about a minute.
Should also say it's pretty tough. I mean, there's some pretty tough. There's an unfortunate event involving lots of racist stuff from Ray Winston's character. Would you just this is quite heavy duty?
Yeah, he's a horrible character. Yeah. I thought Ray Winston was genuinely quite scary in the way he's meant to be, because he does come across as a genuine dangerous bear like presence.
Anastasia and Philip in Dublin, right?
Yeah,
dear Mr. One time my girlfriend cheated on me, and Mr. What's That Got to Do with Me? Not sure about that. We saw London Boulevard last night. The verdict is, if you liked Layer Cake, you'll like London Boulevard, but not as much.
Okay.
Layer Cake is better and funnier and doesn't have Keira Knightley in it. P.S. We ate bagels in the cinema. They were wrapped in crinkly paper. We unwrapped them in the middle of the film.
Okay. I thought Keira Knightley was fine.
I'm afraid he's not good. Michael Brooks at Loughborough University. This week I braved the cold, went to my local multiplex to see the new Colin Farrell brackets Firth movie, London Boulevard. I just thought I'd get in touch to tell you what I think. It's a very good thing William Monaghan can't be plagiarised for stealing his own work, since this film is essentially The Departed relocated from Boston to London.
Yeah, but The Departed was a remake of Infernal Affairs.
Colin Farrell is the Leo DiCaprio figure, unstable hard nut with a vulnerable side, whilst Ray Winston's character is a replica of Jack Nicholson's, from the quirky post-murder observations right down to the goatee beard. Now, I think both are ordinarily fine actors, but here they disappoint, content just to go through the motions, whilst Keira Knightley as a celebrity recluse doesn't even appear to be trying.
It's funny, but I do think that she does fine in it. I think as a celebrity recluse, she came across as a celebrity recluse.
Lloyd Hiscox. The film, London Boulevard, was like a bad episode of The Bill, with a story so ludicrous that even Dallas wouldn't get away with it. The only thing that made it palatable was the slip of accent by Mr. Farrell, who went from Irish to Australian quite frequently.
So nobody mentioned David Thewlis, who was very, very funny.
Helena in Kettering. That's Halina, H-A-L-I-N-A.
Oh, sorry.
Saw London Boulevard last night. Missed the first 5 minutes. Not sure if that was crucial. Thought Anna Friel was excellent and that Colin's accent was suspect. Good film overall. Left wondering what the moral was.
Well, there isn't a moral. It's just it's a crime caper with, you know, with violence.
And with reference to the...
And the good ending.
Harry Potter lighting.
Yep.
Simon, same thing happened to me at my cinema. This is a previous email, if you've just joined us, where the observation was made that a lot of the house lights stayed on, and according to the cinema management, it was in the software which was delivered to them and they couldn't do anything about it. Connor says, same thing happened to me at my cinema watching HP7 when the lights went on during the Seven Potters sequence. They did, however, went away for a few seconds. I can't help but feeling that maybe it wasn't a coincidence other cinemas were affected. Jeremy Reeve says, just thought you'd like to hear that we watched HP last Friday in Didcot in Oxfordshire. Same thing happened to us. I felt like a piece of fish in a fish and chip shop stuck under a very bright ceiling light, and it did rather spoil the atmosphere. Amazing that the cinema cannot override the software.
Yeah,
it's the first time it's happened.
Completely mad.
This seems to be happening up and down the country. Hanley says, in Milton Keynes, had the same issue with the lights at the Monday afternoon screening of Harry Potter. It was originally directed to an earlier showing, which had already begun, and the lights in that screen were off. We'd love to hear what the world of cine have to say about it. I can't see any reason at all.
No.
Because you can't sell anymore.
It's mad.
What would be the point?
Sometimes people have said it's a safety thing so that you don't fall on the way out to the cinema. But, you know, it's like it's a cinema.
Joe in Aberdeen, the light settings are controlled by the digital projector, but the projectionist or manager is in charge of putting the correct settings into the projector. Nothing to do with the film company. We will investigate further. What's next?
We need to do Machete, we need to do Leap Year, we need to do The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, and we need to do Unstoppable. So believe me, it's going to be a fast last 10 minutes.
Okay, you're going to have to be on full throttle.
I am. All right, let me just belt through for you. Leap Year, which won the Camera d'Or at Cannes, directed by an Australian but shot in Mexico. In the director's statement, he describes the film as being rigorously minimalist and says it explores issues that have always obsessed me: loneliness, sexuality, personal spiritual crisis, and difficult to forge emotional bonds, from which I think you can tell that it's not a laugh riot. Monica Del Carmen, you might have seen before in Babel, is a woman living alone in her apartment, looking out through the window at her neighbours, being very, very moved and upset and distressed by the fact that they appear to have loving relationships. She is very lonely and isolated. She brings back to her flat men with whom she has very unfulfilling flings, until she meets a man who appears to have very strong sadistic tendencies but appears to be very nice. He somehow chimes in with her masochism, and they then have a relationship which plays out, I mean, it all plays out within the confines of her apartment in a way that some people have related to Nine Songs, the Michael Winterbottom film, which I disagree with. Some people have said it's an inversion of Last Tango in Paris, the idea of existential desperation being expressed through fairly explicit sexual scenes. Obviously, there is also some relation to things like Taxi Zumklo, in as much as it's incredible what you can now show in an 18-rated movie that in the past would have created great problems for the censors. I think on the positive side, the performances are very, very strong. It is a film, despite the fact that it is about S&M, it is a film which doesn't attempt to be shocking. It does understand quite rightly that in those relationships, the power is held by the passive partner, not by the aggressive partner. It does equate its S&M-ness with Thanatos, what appears to be something leading to a very, very dark place indeed. There are moments of it that are profoundly distressing, although I think they're meant to be. And there is also a very gently withheld but very disturbing subtext as to where her masochism comes from and how this is all leading up to the leap year. It is, in places, very uncomfortable viewing. It is a very humanist film, and I think that it's an interesting piece of work that is essentially held together by the strength of its performances. I would say that some people will find the sexual politics of it not easy to take, but it is to do with understanding that the whole point about the S&M relationship in it is that the power is held by the masochistic party, not the sadistic party.
And if you're on the school run and your kids are just asking you about S&M, it's Simon and Mark.
Simon and Mark, that's right.
That's what it stands
for. Exactly. So, and the power is held by Mark, not Simon.
Well, that entirely is
Machete. Very quickly from there, Machete, which is by Robert Rodriguez, which is basically a film which has come out of the trailer. In the trailer for Grindhouse, in the middle of Grindhouse, they had fake trailers, and a trailer for Machete, which is, now what's happened is that Machete has actually turned from a trailer into a real live film in which Danny Trejo is a guy who wields a machete. He is a great Mexican hero spoken of in quiet terms, very sort of, you know, hushed terms. There is an ongoing border battle in which Robert De Niro plays this hideous senator who is basically encouraging people to go around on shooting missions, taking off people attempting to get across the border. Danny Trejo is a sort of liberation fighter, and it's one of those movies that, you know, tongue solidly in cheek. It is in the end a movie of a trailer, and consequently the overall appeal of it is far less than it was in the trailer. I mean, many Roger Corman movies started life as, here's a poster, here's a tagline, can you make a movie out of it? And what inevitably happened with them is that the movie was never as interesting as the tagline and the poster. In this case, Danny Trejo is funny, great screen presence. There is some great comic violence in it. However, it's that question about, just because you're ironic about something, does it mean you can get away with it? I mean, some people have said that there's a problem with this film in that it panders to racial stereotyping. Well, yes, it also panders to the most gratuitous forms of sexism, but it's like, oh, it's okay because they're ironic. Well, does it not count if it's ironic? Loads and loads of celebrity cameos, most notably Robert De Niro, who is rubbish in it. And finally, on the brief one, A Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, which is the final part of Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy. As you know, we're going to get this remade by David Fincher in American, or English, as some people like to refer to it. It's interesting. The first one, you know, the girl with the dragon tattoo, I thought was really very powerful and very, very nasty. Second one, I thought sort of lost it slightly. This pulls it back. It is televisual as before. There's no question that Fincher's version of this story or the previous story will be more cinematic. But I think they'll be very, very hard pressed to find more convincing leads in the girl who kicked the hornet's nest and in the journalist who is essentially fighting for her story to be out there in public. And there is finally, after this huge amount of time we've spent with these characters, there is a moment in court in which it looks like we're going to get towards some resolution. And the moment in which she dresses up and puts on the Mohican and puts on the, you know, hairsprays up the Mohican and puts on all the, you know, the goth gear, I really felt like standing up and cheering. And I can't remember the last time somebody dressing up as Robert Smith out of The Cure made me feel like, yes, 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 they're going to go and do it. It's flawed, it's overly long, but I have spent a lot of time with the story and I felt that it was finally brought to some kind of conclusion. And I'm kind of understand the disdain that the people who made the original have for the fact that Fincher is now remaking it in American, because they will be very hard-pressed to top those the central performances. Which brings us finally to Unstoppable, right? It's a runaway train movie. There's a train. It's running away. On it are Denzel Washington and Chris Pine, or Malcolm X and Captain Kirk. Is a clip.
Okay, you're getting close. Gap's at a mile and 777's 10 miles to Stanton. Now listen, Frank, I got a guy here named Werner from the FRA. Now I'm inclined to defer to your judgment here, but he...
All right, put him on. We can use all the help that we can get.
Just press this and hold to talk.
It's about slowing 777 once you've tied on. I know conventional wisdom says to just gun it in the opposite direction, but you'll have a better shot alternating full throttle with dynamic braking.
Yeah, but we can't afford to lose counter thrust.
Well, what you'll lose in counter thrust, you'll compensate for in tractive force.
Are you sure about that?
Well, it's more of a hunch based on some quick calculations.
It's a hunch. It was 70 miles an hour and he's giving us a hunch. Okay, thank you. Put Connie back on, please.
It's me, Frank.
Yeah, Connie, this guy know what he's talking about?
In a perfect world, yes. I'd say yes.
In a perfect world, okay.
So, here we are. It's a runaway train movie. At the beginning of the movie, the train runs away. They get on it. They have to stop it before it gets to a place where there's going to be a big bend where it's going to come off the track and all the stuff that's in it, which is bad stuff, is going to fall over and do massive amounts of damage. Okay?
Yes, I've got that.
12A certificate movie, therefore... You know, everyone gets, therefore what they've done is they've cut back on the swearing and the violence, you know, so it's a runaway train movie that pretty much everyone can go and see as long as they go along with a parent and they're not below the age of 8. You know, your 5-year-old's running around. And it is exactly what it says on the packet. It is Tony Scott does Unstoppable. When Tony Scott, with the remake of Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, main problem with that film, train was standing still and John Travolta was shouting. It's like they went, oh yeah, fine. Well, let's have the train running and everyone shouting and that'll be fine. And there's the most unbelievably cliched backstories. One of them is the guy is on the end of his job. He's going to lose his job and they're giving everything to the company. The other is a guy, he's kind of falling out with his wife, but she's watching him on the television. He's being heroic. Whole thing's an advert for Fox News, because most of the stuff you see playing out, people watching the television on Fox News, having all the updates on where it's all going. And, you know, apparently Fox News have got the inside track on this, that and the other. The acting is, you know, manly jaw chewing and, you know, doing all that. Do you think we can do it? I think we can. You think we can stop the train? Well, we got to stop the train. How fast is it going? 70 miles an hour. Well, we got to get down to 35 before we hit the bend. Okay, what are we on? 50. Got to do the thing and then push the what's it. It's a runaway train movie. It is staggeringly unremarkable, but also perfectly efficient. It's not got the invention or the wit or the humour of Speed, which is a much, much better movie, but it's got a runaway train barreling along a track with two guys you quite like, the old guy, the new guy, that he's on the thing and he's on the what's it, they've got to do the thing and one of them's got to jump across and you think they'll manage it. Meanwhile, people are, oh, look, what's happening? It's happening with the train's going to go with the thing and the chugga 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 chugga. No surprises, no spills, no thrills that you didn't expect, but you know what? It's Tony Scott runaway train movie.
Is it the thing or the what's it that actually slows it down in the end? Because I haven't seen it, but I'm imagining that
it's a combination.
My hunch is that there isn't an unfortunate event.
Shall I tell you what it is that
great...
slows it down in the end? What? The thing that slows the train down in the end is the love of a good woman. And the knowledge that in the end, all these things come down to manliness and being in the right place at the right time. It's a Tony Scott runaway train movie. If somebody bought him a tripod, he'd be great. In fact, they could have stopped the train with a tripod, but he doesn't have one of those.
Your runaway train impression was a whole lot better than your aeroplane taking off impression, by the way, just
was
in
it?
Case you needed any kind of balance. So, which brings us, finally, on the BBC's flagship film programme, to Movie of the Week.
Well,
don't tell me it's something you haven't mentioned yet.
No,
we're out of time.
It's been an odd week. You know what? Just to be annoying, girl who kicked the hornet's nest, but probably leapy ear.
Well, can you just come back and look? You got 10 seconds. Which is it?
It's whichever one's playing near you. It's a funny week.
Good. Well, that's been really helpful. Thanks for being precise. Well, that's it for another week. And personally, I thought today's programme was one of the finest that we've done.
I thought it was very good. I was certainly struggling to keep up at the end to get through that many movies, but we didn't let the listeners down in terms of that stuff.
No, we didn't. What do you think of chances of sainthood? You have to be dead, don't you? To be sainted?
It's traditional.
I don't think it's possible.
Sanctified.
In which case, should we wait just a little bit before we are sanctified?
The Justified Ancients of Mu Mu, they were sainted, weren't they?
No, they were
justified. And they're ancient.
But not sanctified.
And they drove an ice cream van.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think sanctification has much to do with that. I don't think KLF was saintly in any way.
Well,
in fact, I remember playing.
This is a whole extra
for podcast.
Tell me about the time that you and Bill Drummond went to Sweden.
Simple Minds sanctified themselves, of course, which sounds indecent almost. Yeah. But if you play the wrong version of a KLF song, you can get in all kinds of trouble. The Justified Ancients of Mu Mu.
Really?
Yeah. Oh yes, because it's based on a sample, which says it starts, and now it's time to. Kick out the jams, and then there's a little kind of
Melon Farmers.
But I played the wrong version, and the Melon Farmers mix went out.
Did it?
Yeah, much to the delight of the head of music from Radio 1, who rang me up and said, "I think you need to take it off." I said, "No, it's all right, it's gone now." He said, "I think there's another one."
There really is.
It's just gone. You've just okay, very good. Anyway, sorry about that. I'd like to apologise for that mistake of many years ago. Well, thanks very much, Steve, for listening. Hope you enjoyed the DVD extras. We'll do some more next week. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Simon.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live. bbc.co.uk/5live.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my Uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.